me back in Manitoba many moons ago.
Time now on Weekend Morning Show for Abandoned Manitoba. Gordon Goldsboro joins us in studio with his latest installment. Good morning, Gordon.
Good morning, Bryce.
Okay, so what do we got on the docket this week?
I receive many emails asking me challenging questions about Manitoba history. I can rarely answer these questions, but I had one recently that intrigued me, so I did some research on it. The answer surprised me, and I thought that our listeners might be interested in that answer. It's our topic this week.
Okay, so what sort of questions are you getting asked?
Many of them relate to genealogical matters. A person maybe had an ancestor who lived and sometimes died in Manitoba, and they need help in tracking them down. You know, I'm a busy guy, and this sort of research could easily consume all my time, so I rarely delve into such questions. But if someone asks a question that genuinely intrigues me, even if I have no idea about the answer and would therefore have to commit time to finding one, I'll usually spend a few minutes looking into it. Occasionally, a question comes along that causes me to, well, literally go down a rabbit hole and spend far more time than I'd prefer, because now I'm invested in finding an answer. Such was the case of a question posed to me recently.
Okay, so this one made the cut. What was this week's question?
Someone emailed to say that he is writing a book of historical fiction set in Winnipeg in the mid-1930s. He wanted his characters to have lunch in either the Grill Room, a restaurant in the former Eaton's department store on Portage Avenue, or in the Georgian Room, the equivalent place in the former Hudson's Bay store, a few blocks away. Would it be historically accurate for the characters to have wine or spirits with their meal? Now, practically speaking, it would make sense for these stores to have a restaurant, so hungry shoppers would have a reason to stay in the store to find a meal. You know, they could eat and then keep shopping, keep spending money. And offering wine, beer, or spirits, you know, certainly would be an additional incentive.
I appreciate the question. It does feel like it has rabbit hole written all over it. So how did you go about answering this question?
Well, in tackling it, my first task was to determine how public sales resumed after Prohibition was repealed in 1923. I found that those wishing to purchase alcohol had to obtain a license from the Manitoba government. This license, which cost $1 a year, allowed someone to buy beer, wine, and spirits in a government-run store for consumption in their residence, which could mean either a private home or a hotel room. There was no option for public liquor consumption. And in fact, customers did not get to carry their purchases home from the store because, you know, who knows how they might be rerouted in transit. Instead, the alcohol was delivered discreetly to their residence, where they were expected to consume it quietly or face revocation of their license to buy more. So no public consumption at all. This was in, say, the early 1920s.
Wow, so much has changed. When was it that public alcohol consumption was permitted?
Well, this happened in 1928 when the government authorized what were called beer parlors to be opened with a dizzying array of restrictions on their operation. So, for example, they could only be established in hotels that had at least 8 bedrooms. I guess that way, if you got too drunk, you could go and pass out on a bed. There had to be separate parlors for men and women who had to be over 21 years of age. But definitely no mixed drinking, because, you know, who knows what might happen if men and women started drinking together. Indigenous people were absolutely prohibited from entering a beer parlor. The parlor sold beer and only beer, not even non-alcoholic beverages. The parlor staff had to be male. Females were emphatically not allowed to be involved in any aspect of sales, handling, or serving beer. The parlors had to have windows that gave an unobstructed view of the interior from the outside, night and day, so everyone could see who was inside drinking. You know, it was almost like public shaming. Look at, there's Bob. He's in having a beer. How decadent. You know, and of course, food, you know, which we think today is sort of ubiquitous everywhere, and, you know, liquor is served, definitely could not be served. And dancing, music, gambling, any form of entertainment, strictly forbidden.
Lots of head scratchers there. Happily, the divisions along gender and racial lines, that is a thing of the past. How long did beer parlors remain in operation?
I'm sure that some of our listeners will remember them, if not having patronized one of those early beer parlors. You know, the paternalistic rules for their operation remained in effect for decades. Finally, in 1956, you know, literally 30 years later, the restriction against food was reversed. So now it wasn't just you couldn't serve food, you had to serve food. You know, you had to provide snacks at least. You know, but on the other hand, the parlors had to close during what was called the supper hour, presumably so drinkers would be required to eat more substantive food. That supper hour rule was not eliminated until, wait for it, 1984. Women were finally allowed to handle, serve, and sell beer as of 1975, but the prohibition on indigenous drinkers was not removed until 1985.
Wow, not that long ago, actually, when you think about it. So back to the key question that you got, when was it that public drinking was allowed in places other than these beer parlors?
I searched historical newspapers, and I found, for example, in 1934, numerous references to the relaxation of public restrictions in Ontario. You know, and so I wondered, well, you know, if Ontario was relaxing them, maybe the neighboring provinces followed suit, you know, sometime maybe in the late 1930s. But this was not the case. And in fact, Manitoba and the other prairie provinces would have harsh restrictions on public drinking for another two decades. You know, things didn't start to change in Manitoba until 1955. That's when former Premier John Bracken led a provincial review of liquor laws that recommended sweeping changes. A new law allowed public dining rooms, cabarets, and restaurants to serve beer and wine with food, finally. As in the past, though, a license was required by these facilities, and in early 1957, one of the first licenses was issued to the dining room in the Royal Alexandra Hotel, located on Higgins Avenue here in Winnipeg, next to the CPR station. As of noon on the 1st of March, 1957, adult men and women were allowed to drink beer and wine together in licensed facilities. And I'm told that the first guests of the Royal Alex to take advantage of this new liberty were Mr. and Mrs. George R. Saunders, who enjoyed a glass of red wine with their lunch.
Which I think takes me to my next question. When could people drink? In the grill room and the Georgian room?
Right. So coming back to my original question that got me started on this rabbit hole. Well, in fact, neither restaurant were among the ones given licenses in 1957. And again, I went back to the historical newspapers and found that the Georgian room was licensed by 1969, but the grill room did not seem to have a license until 1981. So the answer to my original question, patrons to these two restaurants would definitely not be drinking alcohol with their meals in the mid-1930s. Such a thing would not be possible for another 30 or 40 years. You know, and it surprised me that freedom of choice that we take for granted today was not possible as recently as the 1980s. You know, I'm too young to have experienced an old-fashioned beer parlor, so I was blown away by their draconian rules, many of which strike me as downright silly.
Hindsight is 20/20, isn't it? And as you were saying off the hop, you have to be selective with which of the questions that you get that you actually pursue, because it can be a rabbit hole. How long did it take you to find answers to this question?
Well, I didn't keep track exactly, but I estimate that finding an answer to what seemed like initially a fairly innocuous, simple question, it took me, I would say, over 4 hours of solid research. You know, and if I committed this time to every question that is posed to me, I would get nothing else done. You know, and I suppose this is my way of saying that listeners are welcome to send me questions. I do like them, but I warn that I'm not able to help in providing assistance in the vast majority of those cases. Your best hope of engaging my assistance is for your question to be a unique one that truly intrigues me, such as this one did.
Okay, you heard it, folks. Make your pitches compelling. What's up for next week?
Well, 2 years ago, we talked here in Abandoned Manitoba about the basis for some Winnipeg street names. I'm fascinated by the choices that cities make when selecting names, especially when they commemorate people in the community. Next week, we're going to consider how some streets in Portage-la-Prairie got their names, as well as some that remain, well, let's just say, mysterious.
Thanks for this, Gordon.
We'll talk next week. Bye-bye for now.
No matter where I go, every time the wind blows, puts me back in Manitoba, many moons ago.